You're listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C. Today, I'm excited to welcome Yuki Tatsumi, a longtime contributor to The Diplomat. Yuki is a senior director at the Institute for Indo-Pacific Security and a tremendous expert on Japan, Japanese security policymaking, and U.S.-Japan relations. Welcome to the podcast, Yuki.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We are so excited to have you. As our listeners will be well aware, Japan has undergone a wild couple of months on the domestic political front, a churn that certainly may have geopolitical implications. The LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, has been in power in Japan almost continuously since the 50s, with a couple of exceptions. But the party has seen its seat shares in both houses of the Diet decline below a majority this year. Its longtime coalition partner, Komeido, walked out earlier this month. And a new leader and prime minister, the first woman to stand as Japanese prime minister, Takeuchi Sanai, took office this week. So there's a lot going on. Yuki, you know, what is going on in Japanese domestic politics? What sort of trends are we seeing play out here?
Thanks. Thanks again for having me. It's an exciting time to talk about this. And this may be the first time that I get so many questions on Japanese politics, which I'm totally excited about. So I think what's going on in Japanese politics nowadays is that voters are increasingly frustrated with the LDP and its coalition partners. So we'll see, right? I mean, now LDP has a new coalition partner. So we'll see how this one plays out. But it's coalition partner of 26 years, Komeito. So this teaming has been able to deliver to the voters, or lack thereof. They've been frustrated ever since the COVID shutdown happened. And as Japan tried to climb out of that COVID economic impact, average voters have been suffering with the inflation. I think it's not too long ago that we kept reading about how expensive Japanese rice has become for the consumers. And that's a daily staple for Japanese. So it is like a matter of life and death to them, quite literally. And so, yeah. And then inflation, anxiety about the future. And of course, there's increasing pessimism, right, amongst the younger generation of Japanese. They've been forever running on this belief that if they kind of follow this set path of going to good schools and have a stable life, they can retire comfortably. And, you know, they go on their merry life for the rest of their lives. But that lifestyle is increasingly collapsing at the accelerated pace without any big shift in the business culture, mm-hmm. corporate culture, and so forth. So there's a mounting frustration, and I think it has been steadily mounting for the last 20, 30 years since Japan kept talking about, you know, lost decade of economic vitality, which became then two decades of lost decades. And now we're well under like third decade into it. So I think it is just we're seeing the manifestation of the voters' frustration. And now as a result, voters has given up on keep giving the majority seat with the LDP Komeito ruling coalition. But they really are not quite confident yet about the other opposition parties. So what mm-hmm. we see right now is LDP continue to hold the most number of seats. But there are hodgepodge of opposition parties. So that puts LDP in a kind of a bind, because it needs more than one party at this point, unless they decided to cross the Rubicon and align with the Constitutional Democratic Party, which doesn't really meet eye to eye with LDP on some of the fundamental policies. Unless they choose that path, they need at least two coalition partners to get anything done. So I think what we're seeing right now is really great uncertainty, is a short, you know, to be simply put, but growing number of a smaller number of opposition party that has a very sharp message that voter resonates. And yet those parties on their own couldn't quite reach the majority, because voters still on the bind of, can we really trust them with the governing yet? Because they really have not forgotten the incapacity of the Democratic Party of Japan in the early part of the 21st century, which merely hang on to power for like the 3 years or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think you highlighted a number of things that I think we've discussed globally, sort of uncertainty, discontent with incumbent politics and parties. And we're sort of seeing this play out in the Japanese context. And so it's really interesting, the sort of hedging behavior on the part of voters. You know, they're not certain the LDP is going to get them where they want to go, but there's not really anybody else that they have faith in. So we'll see how that goes. Given that this is the Asia Geopolitics podcast, I think we'll expand a little, and I kind of want to get into the regional picture. You know, Takeuchi is often discussed as being ultra conservative, in the vein of her mentor Abe, and has generated, I think, some concern about how she'll approach South Korea in particular. Are those concerns valid, and what do we expect at this juncture? You know, it's early days, but what do we expect from Takeuchi when it comes to the Japan-South Korea relationship?
I think that's a great question. And I am aware of this concerns on the part of South Korea as far as Takeuchi's policy trajectory. Mm-hmm. But I think if this anything is a guide, we should look at and listen to what Takeuchi said in response to the question presented by the reporter from Chosin Ilbo during her first press conference as a prime minister. So this reporter from Chosin Ilbo spoke explicitly about concerns within South Korea. But then she actually started off by saying, "I really think South Korea is a very important neighbor for Japan. We have much to cooperate. I'd like to establish a forward-looking relationship. I really look forward to meeting your new president, President Lee." And also she, you know, also tried to soften the tones and soften her image almost, mm-hmm. saying, "Look, I love Korean seaweed. I use Korean cosmetics, which I think is great. And then I'm also a fan of Korean drama." So I think she is really, now that she's at the place where she can govern, and she is governing, she is kind of following the playbook of the Prime Minister Abe when he became the Prime Minister for the second time in 2012, which is first time, you know, 2006 to 2007, he kind of led his kind of a preconceived image of being a right-wing and conservative, kind of, you know, let it be. But then I think when he returned to the office, he really made the conscious effort to present himself as, yes, I may be a conservative politician, but I'm also very pragmatic. And I'm more interested in doing what's in Japan's national interest than sticking with my political creed or ideology. So I think that's the playbook that Takeuchi's tried to play. And I think she's delivering her first policy speech at the Prime Minister's Diet on Sunday, right before President Trump landed on them. So I think we then probably will know more about how her attempt to be more pragmatic Prime Minister will play out. But I think at initial outset, I think she's already setting the tone of, look, you know, just because I'm conservative doesn't mean that you're going to continue to see the repeat of what has been, you know, what the concerns that have been played out.
That's a very good point. I think we see a lot when leaders come into power, the sort of mantle of leadership tends to moderate some of the more ideological positions. Not always. And I think it'll be interesting to watch how that plays out in Japan, given what we discussed previously, where some voters aren't certain about the LDP. And so I can imagine that more conservative voters are going to be unhappy at this moderation, while many other voters are going to be sort of okay with that. So we'll see how that pans out on the South Korea relationship. I want to turn to China next. You know, how has the sort of turmoil in Japanese politics and the turnover of prime ministers in the last couple of years been received in Beijing? What do we know at this early juncture about how the new Japanese prime minister kind of intends to approach the China relationship, which is certainly really important, just as important as the South Korea relationship, but has many other dynamics within it.
Absolutely. So I think China is the probably the only country on the planet that really explicitly voiced the concerns when Takeuchi first became the prime minister. And then I only read the translation of it, but I do see some Chinese media describing her as a, you know, female version of Trump. But I kind of have an issue with that because I think Takaichi will be far more predictable in terms of her policy trajectory and consistency of what her behavior and decision-making pattern will be compared to President Trump. But I think that kind of says it all, right? They are, I think, expecting her to be more hardline, doesn't take any kind of aggressive stance coming out of Beijing as it is. She will definitely try to push back. And then I think also we all have to remember that before she became a prime minister, the last cabinet position she served was a minister for economic security. So she really spearheaded this legislation about security clearance, industrial security, you know, all that. And then I think she's already moving, you know, making a move in terms of, you know, along that trend line. So I think we definitely continue to see that. And then also, when you look at her key senior government appointment, including cabinet, ostensibly in Japanese government, chief cabinet secretary is the most important position. In the U.S., in American terms, that's vice president, chief of staff, and national security advisor in one. And who does she appoint to that position? Minoru Kihara, who was a defense minister under Prime Minister Kishida. And also, you know, she appointed for the first time for the prime minister's special advisor for national security as a retired three-star Air Force general. Now, he is from, you know, they do have a, you know, commonality that he is also from Nara Prefecture. But then, you know, he is also, and then, you know, it's not like he's like a warmongering. He's very deliberate, thoughtful, strategic thinking officer, you know, retired general. But I think that also speaks volume about how she considers Japanese national security and the security environment Japan is placed under. So I definitely think she will make a concerted effort to follow on the line that Prime Minister Abe tried to follow and then Kishida tried to follow, which is continuing to boost Japan's own defense capability and its own deterrence capability. And that will definitely doesn't play well in China. China will definitely be concerned about that.
I want to dive a little bit more into the defense and the security angle before we kind of get back to Donald Trump and the United States and the visit that's about to happen. You know, you pointed out a number of key appointments sort of point to a bringing in of national security and defense expertise into the cabinet. You know, how does Takeuchi approach sort of the matter of Japanese security and sort of the sensitive questions on constitutional understanding? You know, I guess it's Article 9. That sort of stuff. How do we expect her to approach those issues?
I think long term, I do think that Prime Minister Takaichi wants to revise Article 9 in the sense that not in the direction that most people associate this debate with, that I don't think she necessarily revised Article 9 in a sense that, okay, now Japan is allowing self-defense force to participate in expeditionary warfare. But I really don't think that will happen. But I think the constitutional revision that she has in mind, and also what Abe and rest of the most of the conservative politicians in mind is that let's call self-defense force for what it is. You know, it is a national military professional military organization, and we do need to give them a constitutional place in which where it does enjoy the status equivalent of its colleagues internationally. So I think that is definitely something that she has in a long term, and I think that also manifested itself in her pick of a coalition partner, which is Nihon Ishin no Kai, Japan Innovation Party, which kind of shares that trajectory when it comes to constitution and national defense. And then I do think that she would like to accelerate the pace in which Japan boosts up its own defense capability. She already committed her government to begin the revision of a national security strategy and national defense strategy and also defense build-up plan, that set of the three documents, a year ahead of time. And then I think there I can definitely see her try to accelerate the pace at which, let's say, Japan acquires some of the capability that's already spelled out in the current defense buildup plan, including a preemption capability. But then I will not be surprised if she try to incorporate more of Japan's heavier investment in more of emerging technology and how to operationalize those emerging technology into the actual defense operations, into that the defense strategy as well. So I think those are whole, you know, slew. And then there are all other issues in terms of investment in the supply, you know, supply capability and logistic capability and munition production, more investment or more encouragement to push defense industry to be more competitive internationally, more, you know, partnering opportunities with its U.S. and other like-minded countries' defense industries. So I do see those kind of a more active defense diplomacy and an industrial policy aspect of it coming into play.
All right. Well, we will be watching for that. And to sort of wrap us up, you know, as we're recording, it's October 24th. U.S. President Donald Trump is preparing to leave on a big trip to Asia, which will include a stop in Japan. What do we know about how Takeuchi intends to approach the U.S. alliance? How are people sort of looking at this? And then, you know, what are you watching for during this visit? What would be a mark of success and what would be a sort of disastrous failure?
So I think we, you know, whenever Donald Trump meets foreign leaders for the first time, we all kind of suck the air into our teeth, and then, you know, we'll kind of see on the holding pattern. I think Prime Minister Takeuchi definitely wants to present herself as the successor of Prime Minister Abe, who President Trump to this day speaks very, very fondly of, and almost, you know, there's almost like a nostalgia into, you know, the way that he refers to him. And also how I think she would probably emphasize more continuity from his line of the policies than necessarily previous governments, you know, Prime Minister Shiba's policy, for example. Mm-hmm. And then also she probably would like to present herself to him as a fighter. You know, she, let's face it, she really broke the really thick glass ceiling for a Japanese female politician. And not giving up on her, you know, ambitions and policy goals. She wants to get things done. I think that's one another thing that she would like to emphasize. And then also, I think she probably would like to put him at a little bit of a piece about emphasizing that what has been agreed between her predecessor government and his administration in terms of big tariff deal, investment deal, she would, you know, she intends on honoring that. And she already signals that by keeping the Minister Akazawa as the METI minister, who was a tariff chief negotiator. So that certainly is welcomed by, I'm sure, Commerce Secretary Lutnick and Treasury Secretary Bessent and a USTR Greer. So she does hold continuity in some of those important linkage with the Trump administration. But I think she also would like to portray herself as a very different leader than the Prime Minister Ishiba. Mm-hmm. And she will probably, you know, try to describe herself more in the line of Prime Minister Abe. So during the summit, I would definitely closely watch their body language, because President Trump kind of tends to wear feelings on his sleeves. And that really comes out strong, the way that, you know, he motions, you know, make emotions to foreign leaders. And then I see that night and day difference, right? For example, his relationship with the President Zelensky, you know, it's so different that his mannerism and everything else, looking back, comparing how he behaved toward President Zelensky back in February to the way he, you know, approached him now. So I think I would watch both leaders' body language very, very closely.
Yeah, no, you can tell when Donald Trump doesn't want to be in a room very easily. Well, thank you so much, Yuki, for joining me today. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you don't miss out on future episodes. You can also now watch these episodes on our YouTube channel, if that is your thing. And as always, you can get in touch with me or my co-host Ankit with episode suggestions or questions. We'll be back soon with more. Thanks again, Yuki.
Thank you.